Hivrin? Dunworthy said and started toward her. Don't come any closer, she said in English, holding the stick out in front of her like a gun. Its end was broken off jaggedly. It's me, Kivrin. Mr. Dunworthy, he said, still walking toward her. No, she said, and backed away, jabbing the broken spade at him. You don't understand. It's the plague.
It's all right, Kivrin. We've been inoculated.
Inoculated, she said, as if she didn't know what the word meant. It was the bishop's clerk. He had it when they came.
Colin ran up, and she raised the stick again.
It's all right, Dunworthy said again. This is Colin. He's been inoculated as well. We've come to take you home.
She looked at him steadily for a long minute, the snow falling around them. To take me home, she said, no expression in her voice, and looked down at the grave at her feet. It was shorter than the others and narrower, as if it held a child. After a minute, she looked up at Dunworthy, and there was no expression in her face either.
I am too late, he thought despairingly, looking at her standing there in her bloody smock surrounded by graves. They have already crucified her.
Kivrin, he said. She let the spade fall. You must help me, she said, and turned and walked away from them toward the church.
Are you sure it's her?
Colin whispered.
Yes, he said.
What's the matter with her?
I'm too late, he thought,
and put his hand on Colin's shoulder for support. She will never forgive me.
What's wrong?
Colin asked. Are you feeling ill again?
No,
he said. But he waited a moment before he took his hand away. Kivrin had stopped at the church door and was holding her side again. Chill went through him.
She has it, he thought. She has the plague.
Are you ill? He asked.
No, she said. She took her hand away and looked at it, as if she expected it to be covered in blood.
He kicked me.
She tried to push the church door open, winced, and let Colin.
I think he broke some ribs.
Colin got the heavy wooden door open, and they went inside. Dunworthy blinked against the darkness, willing his eyes to adjust to it. There was no light at all from the narrow windows, though he could tell where they were. He could make out a low, heavy shape ahead on the left. A body, and the darker masses of the first pillars. But beyond them, it was completely dark. Beside him, Colin was fumbling in his baggy pockets. Far ahead, a flame flickered, illuminating nothing but itself. It went out. Dunworthy started toward it.
Hold on a minute,
Colin said, and flashed on a pocket torch. It blinded Dunworthy, making everything outside its diffused beam as black as when they first came in. Colin shone it around the church, on the painted walls, the heavy pillars, the uneven floor. The light caught on the shape Dunworthy had thought was a body. It was a stone tomb.
She's up there, Dunworthy said, pointing toward the altar, and Colin obligingly aimed the torch in that direction.
Kivrin was kneeling by someone who lay on the floor in front of the rude screen. It was a man, Dunworthy saw as they came closer. His legs and lower body were covered with a purple blanket, and his large hands were crossed on his chest. Kivrin was trying to light a candle with a coal, but the candle had burned down into a misshapen stub of wax and would not stay lit. She seemed grateful when Colin came up with his torch. He shone it full on them. You must help me with Roche, she said, squinting into the light. She leaned toward the man and reached for his hand.
She thinks he's still alive, Dunworthy thought.
But she said in that flat, matter-of-fact voice, he died this morning. Colin shone the pocket torch on the body. The crossed hands were nearly as purple as the blanket in the harsh light of the torch, but the man's face was pale and utterly at peace.
What was he? A knight? Colin said wonderingly.
No, Kivrin said. A saint. She laid her hand on his stiff one. Her hand was calloused and bloody, the fingernails black with dirt. You must help me, she said.
Help you what? Colin asked.
She wants us to help her bury him, Dunworthy thought. And we can't. The man she had called Roche was huge. He must have towered over Kivrin when he was alive. Even if they could dig a grave, the three of them together could not carry him. And Kivrin would never let them put a rope around his neck and drag him out to the churchyard.
Help you what? Colin said. We don't have much time.
They hadn't any time. It was already late afternoon, and they would never find their way through the forest after dark, and there was no telling how long Badri could keep the intermittent going. He had said 24 hours, but he had not looked strong enough to last 2, and it had already been nearly 8. And the ground was frozen, and Kivrin's ribs were broken, and the effects of the aspirin were wearing off. He was beginning to shiver again here in the cold church. We can't bury him, he thought, looking at her kneeling there. And how can I tell her that when I have arrived too late for anything else? Kivrin, he said.
She patted the stiff hand gently. We won't be able to bury him, she said, in that calm, expressionless voice. We had to put Rosamond in his grave, after the steward... She looked up at Dunworthy. I tried to dig another one this morning, but the ground's too hard. I broke the spade. She looked up at Dunworthy. I said the mass for the dead for him, and I tried to ring the bell.
We heard you, Colin said. That's how we found you.
It should have been 9 strokes, she said. But I had to stop. She put her hand to her side as if remembering pain. You must help me ring the rest.
Why?
Colin said. I don't think there's anybody left alive to hear it.
It doesn't matter, Kivrin said, looking at Dunworthy.
We haven't time, Colin said. It'll be dark soon, and the drop is...
I'll ring it, Dunworthy said. He stood up. You stay there, he said, though she had made no move to get up. I'll ring the bell. He started back down the nave.
It's getting dark, Colin said, trotting to catch up with him, the light from his torch dancing crazily over the pillars and the floor as he ran. And you said you didn't know how long they could hold the net open.
Wait a minute!
Dunworthy pushed open the door, squinting against the unexpected glare of the snow. But it had grown darker while they were in the church, the sky heavy and smelling of snow. He walked rapidly across the churchyard to the bell tower. The cow that Colin had seen when they rode in the village ducked through the lych gate and ambled across the graves toward them, its hooves sinking in the snow.
What's the use of ringing it when there's no one to hear it? Colin said, stopping to switch off his torch and then running to catch up again.
Dunworthy went in the tower, It was as dark and cold as the church and smelled of rats. The cow poked its head in, and Colin squeezed past it and stood against the curving wall.
You're the one who keeps saying we have to get back to the drop, that it's going to close and leave us here, Colin said. You're the one who said we didn't even have time to find Kivrin.
Dunworthy stood there a moment, letting his eyes adjust and trying to catch his breath. He had walked too fast, and the tightness in his chest was back. He looked up at the rope. It hung above their heads in the darkness, a greasy-looking knot a foot from the frayed end.
Can I ring it?
Colin said, staring up at it.
You're too small, Dunworthy said.
I'm not, he said, and jumped up at the rope. He caught the end below the knot and hung on for several moments before dropping, but the rope scarcely moved, and the bell only clanged faintly and out of tune, as if someone had hit the side of it with a rock.
It's heavy, he said.
Dunworthy raised his arms and took hold of the rough rope. It was cold and bristly. He yanked sharply down, not sure he could do any better than Colin, and the rope cut into his hands. Bong!
It's loud,
Colin said, clapping his hands over his ears and gazing delightedly up at it.
One, Dunworthy said. One and up.
Remembering the Americans, he bent his knees and pulled straight down on the rope. Two and up. And three. He wondered how Kivrin had been able to ring any strokes at all with her hurt ribs. The bell was far heavier, far louder than he had imagined, and it seemed to reverberate in his head, his tightening chest. Bong! He thought of Miss Piantini bending her chubby knees and counting to herself. Five. He had not appreciated what difficult work it was. Each pull seemed to yank the breath out of his lungs. Six. He wanted to stop and rest, but he didn't want Kivrin listening inside the church to think he had quit, that he had only intended to finish the strokes she had begun. He tightened his grip above the knot and leaned against the stone wall for a moment, trying to ease the tightness in his chest.
Are you all right, Mr. Dunworthy? Colin said.
Yes,
he said, and pulled down so hard it seemed to tear his lungs open.
Seven.
He should not have leaned against the wall. The stones were cold as ice. They had set him shivering again. He thought of Miss Taylor, trying to finish the Chicago Surprise Minor, counting how many strokes were left, trying not to give in to the pounding in her head.
I can finish it, Colin said, and Dunworthy could scarcely hear him. I can go get Kivrin, and we can do the last two strokes. We can both pull on it.
Dunworthy shook his head.
Every man must stick to his bell, he said breathlessly, and yanked down on the rope.
Eight. He must not let go of the rope. Miss Taylor had fainted and let it go, and the bell had swung right over, the rope whipping like a live thing. It had wrapped itself around Finch's neck and nearly strangled him. He must hold to it in spite of everything. He pulled down on the rope and hung on to it till he was certain he could stand and then let it rise.
Nine, he said.
Colin was frowning at him. You're having a relapse, aren't you? He said suspiciously.
No,
Dunworthy said, and let go of the rope. The cow had its head in the door. He pushed it roughly aside and walked back to the church and went inside. Kivrin was still kneeling beside Roche, her hand still holding his stiff one. He stopped in front of her.
I rang the bell, he said.
She looked up without nodding.
Don't you think we'd better go now?
Colin said.
It's getting dark.
Yes, Dunworthy said. I think we'd best.
The dizziness caught him completely unawares, and he staggered and nearly fell into Roche's body. Kivrin put out her hand, and Colin dived for him, the torch flashing erratically across the ceiling as he grabbed Dunworthy's arm. He caught himself on one knee in the flat of his hand and reached out with the other for Kivrin,
but she was on her feet and backing away. You're ill. It was an accusation, an indictment. You've caught the plague, haven't you? She said, her voice showing emotion for the first time. Haven't you?
No, Dunworthy said.
He's having a relapse, Colin said, sticking the torch in the crook of the statue's arm so he could help Dunworthy to a sitting position. He didn't pay any attention to my placards.
It's a virus, Dunworthy said, sitting down with his back to the statue. Not the plague. Both of us have had streptomycin and gamma globulin. We can't get the plague. He leaned his head back against the statue. It's a virus. I'll be all right. I only need to rest a moment.
I told him he shouldn't have rung the bell, Colin said, emptying the burlap sack onto the stone floor. He wrapped the empty sack around Dunworthy's shoulders.
Are there any aspirin left? Dunworthy asked.
You're only supposed to take them every 3 hours, Colin said, and you're not supposed to take them without water.
Then fetch me some water, he snapped.
Colin looked to Kivrin for support, but she was still standing on the other side of Roche's body, watching Dunworthy warily.
Now, Dunworthy said, and Colin ran out, his boots echoing on the stone floor.
Dunworthy looked across at Kivrin and she took a step back.
It isn't the plague, he said. It's a virus. We were afraid you had been exposed to it before you came through and had come down with it. Did you?
Yes, she said, and knelt beside Roche. He saved my life. She smoothed the purple blanket, and Dunworthy realized it was a velvet cloak. It had a large silk cross sewn in the center of it. He told me not to be afraid, she said. She pulled the cloak up over his chest, under his crossed hands. But the action left his feet, in thick, incongruous sandals, uncovered. Dunworthy took the burlap bag from around his shoulders and spread it gently over the feet, and then stood up carefully, holding onto the statue so he wouldn't fall down. Kivrin patted Roche's hands. He didn't mean to hurt me, she said. Colin came back in with a bucket half full of water he must have found in a puddle. He was breathing hard. The cow attacked me, he said, scooping a filthy dipper out of the bucket. He emptied the aspirin into Dunworthy's hand. There were 5 tablets. Dunworthy took 2 of them, swallowing as little of the water as he could, and handed the others to Kivrin. She took them from him solemnly, still kneeling on the floor. I couldn't find any horses, Colin said, handing Kivrin the dipper. Just a mule. Donkey, Kivrin said. Maisri stole Agnes's pony.
She gave Colin the dipper and took hold of Roche's hand again.
He rang the bell for everyone, so their souls could go safely to heaven.
Don't you think we'd better be going? Colin whispered. It's almost dark out.
Even Rosamond, Kivrin said, as if she hadn't heard. He was already ill. I told him there wasn't time, that we had to leave for Scotland.
We must go now, Dunworthy said, before the light fails.
She didn't move or let go of Roche's hand. He held my hand when I was dying.
Kivrin, he said gently. She laid her hand on Roche's cheek, looked at him a long moment, and then got to her feet. Dunworthy offered her his hand, but she stood up by herself, her hand pressed to her side, and walked down the nave.
At the door, she turned and looked back into the darkness. He told me where the drop was when he was dying, so I could go back to heaven. He told me he wanted me to leave him there and go, so that when he came, I would already be there, she said, and went out into the snow. Chapter 36. The snow fell silently, peacefully on the stallion and the donkey waiting by the lich gate. Dunworthy helped Kivrin onto the stallion, and she did not flinch away from his touch as he had been afraid she would, but as soon as she was up, she leaned away from his grasp and took hold of the reins. As soon as he removed his hands, she slumped back against the saddle, her hand against her side. Dunworthy was shivering now, clenching his teeth against it so Colin wouldn't see. It took 3 tries to get him onto the donkey, and he thought he might slip off at any minute. "I think I'd better lead your mule," Colin said, looking disapprovingly at him. "There isn't time," Dunworthy said. "It's getting dark. You ride behind Kivrin." Colin led the stallion over to the lich gate, climbed up on the lintel, and scrambled up behind Kivrin. "Do you have the locator?" Dunworthy said, trying to kick the donkey without falling off.
"I know the way," Kivrin said.
"Yes," Colin said. He held it up. "And the pocket torch." He flicked it on and then shone it all around the churchyard, as if looking for something they might have left behind. He seemed to notice the graves for the first time. "Is that where you buried everybody?" he said, holding the light steady on the smooth white mounds.
"Yes," Kivrin said.
"Did they die a long time ago?" She turned the stallion and started it up the hill.
"No," she said.
The cow followed them partway up the hill, its swollen udders swinging, and then stopped and began lowing pitifully. Dunworthy looked back at it. It mooed uncertainly at him, and then ambled back down the road toward the village. They were nearly to the top of the hill, and the snow was letting up, but below, in the village, it was still snowing hard. The graves were covered completely, and the church was obscured, the bell tower scarcely visible at all. Kivrin did not so much as glance back. She rode steadily forward, sitting very straight, with Colin on behind her, holding not to Kivrin's waist, but to the high back of the saddle. The snow came down fitfully, and then in single flakes, and by the time they were in thick woods again, it had nearly stopped. Dunworthy followed the horse, trying to keep up with its steady gait, trying not to give way to the fever. The aspirin was not working. He had taken it with too little water, and he could feel the fever beginning to overtake him, beginning to shut out the woods and the donkey's bony back and Colin's voice. He was talking cheerfully to Kivrin, telling her about the epidemic, and the way he told it, it sounded like an adventure. "They said there was a quarantine, and we'd have to go back to London, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to see Great Aunt Mary, so I sneaked through the barrier, and the guards saw me and said, 'You there, stop!' and started to chase me, and I ran down the street and into this alley." They stopped, and Colin and Kivrin dismounted. Colin took off his muffler, and she pulled up her blood-stiff smock and tied it around her ribs. Dunworthy knew the pain must be even worse than he thought, that he should try at least to help her, but he was afraid that if he got down off the donkey, he would not be able to get back on. Kivrin and Colin mounted again, she helping him up, and they set off again, slowing at every turning and side path to check their direction. Colin hunching over the locator's screen and pointing, Kivrin nodding in confirmation.
"This was where I fell off the donkey," Kivrin said,
when they stopped at a fork.
"That first night I was so sick. I thought he was a cutthroat."
They came to another fork.
It had stopped snowing, but the clouds above the trees were dark and heavy. Colin had to shine his torch on the locator to read it. He pointed down the right-hand path and got on behind Kivrin again, telling her his adventures.
"Mr. Dunworthy said, 'You've lost the fix,' and then he went straight over into Mr. Gilchrist, and they both fell down," Colin said. "Mr. Gilchrist was acting like he'd done it on purpose. He wouldn't even help me cover him up. He was shivering like blood, and he had a fever, and I kept shouting, 'Mr. Dunworthy, Mr. Dunworthy,' but he couldn't hear me. And Mr. Gilchrist kept saying, 'I'm holding you personally responsible.'" It began to spit snow again, and the wind picked up. Dunworthy clung to the donkey's stiff mane, shivering.
"They wouldn't tell me anything," Colin was saying. "And when I tried to get in to see Great Aunt Mary, they said, 'We don't allow children.'"
They were riding into the wind, the snow blowing against Dunworthy's cloak in freezing gusts. He leaned forward till he was nearly lying on the donkey's neck.
"The doctor came out," Colin said, "and he started whispering to this nurse, and I knew she was dead."
And Dunworthy felt a sudden stab of grief, as if he were hearing it for the first time. "Oh, Mary," he thought.
"I didn't know what to do," Colin said. "So I just sat there. And Mrs. Gadsden, she's this necrotic person, came up and started reading to me out of the Bible how it was God's will. I hate Mrs. Gadsden," he said violently. "She's the one who deserved to get the flu."
Their voices began to ring, the overtones echoing against and around the woods, so that he shouldn't have been able to understand them, but oddly they rang clearer and clearer in the cold air, and he thought they must be able to hear them all the way to Oxford, 700 years away. It came to Dunworthy suddenly that Mary wasn't dead. That here in this terrible year, in this century that was worse than a 10, she had not yet died. And it seemed to him a blessing beyond any he had any right to expect.
"And that was when we heard the bell," Colin said. "Mr. Dunworthy said it was you calling for help."
"It was," Kivrin said. "This won't work. He'll fall off."
"You're right," Colin said. And Dunworthy realized that they had dismounted again and were standing next to the donkey, Kivrin holding the rope bridle.
"We have to put you on the horse," Kivrin said, taking hold of Dunworthy's waist. "You're going to fall off the donkey. Come on, get down. I'll help you."
They both had to help him down, Kivrin reaching around him in a way he knew had to hurt her ribs, Colin almost holding him up.
"If I could just sit down for a moment," Dunworthy said through chattering teeth.
"There isn't time," Colin said.
But they helped him to the side of the path and eased him down against a rock. Kivrin reached up under her smock and brought out 3 aspirin.
"Here, take these," she said, holding them out to him on her open palm.
"Those were for you," he said. "Your ribs."
She looked at him steadily, unsmilingly. "I'll be all right," she said, and went to tie the stallion to a bush.
"Do you want some water?" Colin said. "I could build a fire and melt some snow."
"I'll be all right," Dunworthy said.
He put the aspirin in his mouth and swallowed them. Kivrin was adjusting the stirrups, untying the leather straps with practiced skill. She knotted them and came back over to Dunworthy to help him up.
"Ready?" she said, putting her hand under his arm.
"Yes," Dunworthy said, and tried to stand up.
"This was a mistake," Colin said. "We'll never get him on."
But they did,
putting his foot in the stirrups and his hands around the pommel and hoisting him up. And at the end he was even able to help them a little, offering a hand so Colin could clamber up the side of the stallion in front of him. He had stopped shivering, but he was not sure whether that was a good sign or not. And when they started off again, Kivrin ahead on the jolting donkey, Colin already talking, he leaned into Colin's back and closed his eyes. "So I decided that when I get out of school, I'm going to come to Oxford and be an historian like you," Colin was saying. "I don't want to come to the Black Death. I want to go to the Crusades." He listened to them, leaning against Colin. It was getting dark, and they were in the Middle Ages, in the woods, two cripples and a child, and Badri, another cripple, trying to hold the net open and susceptible to relapse himself. But he could not seem to summon any panic or even any worry. Colin had the locator, and Kivrin knew where the drop was. They would be all right. Even if they could not find the drop, and they were trapped here forever, even if Kivrin could not forgive him, she would be all right. She would take them to Scotland, where the plague never went, and Colin would pull fish hooks and a frying pan out of his bag of tricks, and they would catch trout and salmon to eat. They might even find Basingham. "I watch sword fighting on the vids, and I know how to drive a horse," Colin said, and then, "Stop!" Colin jerked the reins back and up, and the stallion stopped its nose against the donkey's tail. The donkey had stopped short. They were at the top of a little hill. At its bottom was a frozen puddle and a line of willows. "Kick it," Colin said. The Kivrin was already dismounting. "He won't go any farther," she said. "He did this before. He saw me come through. I thought it was Garwin, but it was Roche all along." She pulled the rope bridle off over the donkey's head, and it immediately trotted back along the narrow path. "Do you want to ride?" Colin asked her, already scrambling down. She shook her head. "It hurts more mounting and dismounting than walking." She was looking across at the farther hill. The trees were only halfway up, and above them the hill was white with snow. It must have stopped snowing, though Dunworthy hadn't been aware of it. The clouds were breaking up, and between them the sky was a pale, clear lavender. "He thought I was St. Catherine," she said. "He saw me come through, like you were afraid would happen. He thought I had been sent from God to help them in their hour of need." "Well, and you did, didn't you?" Colin said. He jerked the reins awkwardly, and the stallion started down the hill, Kivrin walking beside it. "You should have seen the mess in the other place we were. Bodies everywhere, and I don't think anybody helped them." He handed the reins to Kivrin. "I'll go see if the net's open," he said, and ran ahead. Badri was going to open it every 2 hours. He crashed into the thicket and disappeared. Kivrin brought the stallion to a stop at the bottom of the hill and helped Dunworthy down.
"We'd best take his saddle and bridle off," Dunworthy said. "When we found him, he was tangled in a bush."
Together they got the girth uncinched and the saddle off. Kivrin unhooked the bridle and reached up to stroke the stallion's head.
"You'll be all right," Dunworthy said.
"Maybe," she said. Colin burst through the willows, scattering snow everywhere. "It's not open."
"It'll open soon," Dunworthy said.
"Are we taking the horse with us?" Colin asked. "I thought historians weren't allowed to take anything into the future, but it'd be great if we could take him. I could ride him when I go to the Crusades."
He exploded back through the thicket, spraying snow.
Come on, you guys, it could open any time.
Kivrin nodded. She smacked the stallion on its flank. It walked a few paces and then stopped, and then looked back at them questioningly.
Come on,
Colin said from somewhere inside the thicket. But Kivrin didn't move. She put her hand against her side.
Kivrin,
he said, moving to help her.
I'll be all right, she said,
and turned away from him to push aside the tangled branches of the thicket. It was already twilight under the trees. The sky between the black branches of the oak was lavender blue. Colin was dragging a fallen log into the middle of the clearing.
In case we just missed it and have to wait a whole 2 hours, he said.
Dunworthy sat down gratefully.
How do we know where to stand when the net opens?
Colin asked Kivrin.
We'll be able to see the condensation, she said.
She went over to the oak tree and bent down to brush the snow away from its base.
What if it gets dark?
Colin asked. She sat down against the tree, biting her lips as she eased herself onto the roots. Colin squatted down between them.
I didn't bring any matches, or I'd start a fire, he said.
It's all right, Dunworthy said.
Colin switched on his pocket torch and then switched it off again.
I think I better save this in case something goes wrong.
There was a movement in the willows. Colin leaped up.
I think it's starting, he said.
It's a stallion, Dunworthy said. He's eating.
Oh.
Colin sat back down.
You don't think the net already opened and we didn't see it because it was dark?
No, Dunworthy said.
Perhaps Vadri had another relapse and couldn't keep the net open,
he said, sounding more excited than scared. They waited. The sky darkened to purple-blue, and stars began to come out in the branches of the oak. Colin sat on the log beside Dunworthy and talked about the Crusades.
You know all about the Middle Ages, he said to Kivrin. So I thought perhaps you'd help me get ready, you know, teach me things.
You're not old enough, she said. It's very dangerous.
I know, Colin said. But I really want to go. You have to help me, please.
It won't be anything like you expect, she said.
Is the food necrotic? I read in this book Mr. Dunworthy gave me how they ate spoiled meat and swans and things.
Kivrin looked down at her hands for a long minute.
Most of it was terrible, she said softly. But there were some wonderful things.
Wonderful things.
He thought of Mary leaning against Balliol's gate, talking about the Valley of the Kings, saying, I'll never forget it.
Wonderful things.
What about Brussels sprouts? Colin asked. Did they eat Brussels sprouts in the Middle Ages?
Kivrin almost smiled.
I don't think they were invented yet.
Good!
He jumped up.
Did you hear that? I think it's starting. It sounds like a bell.
Kivrin raised her head, listening.
A bell was ringing when I came through, she said. Come on,
Colin said, and yanked Dunworthy to his feet.
Can't you hear it?
It was a bell, faint and far away.
It's coming from over here,
Colin said. He darted to the edge of the clearing.
Come on.
Kivrin put her hand on the ground for support and got to her knees. A free hand went involuntarily to her side. Dunworthy reached his hand out to her, but she didn't take it.
I'll be all right,
she said quietly.
I know, he said,
and let his hand drop. She stood up carefully, holding on to the rough trunk of the oak, and then straightened and stood free of it.
"I got it all on the corder," she said. "Everything that happened."
"Like John Clynn," he thought, looking at her ragged hair, her dirty face. "A true historian, writing in the empty church, surrounded by graves. I, seeing so many evils, have put into writing all the things that I have witnessed, lest things which should be remembered perish with time."
Kivrin turned her palms up and looked at her wrist in the twilight. "Father Roche, and Agnes, and Rosamond, and all of them," she said. "I got it all down." She traced a line down the side of her wrist with her finger. "Io suicien lui damo amo," she said softly. "You are here in place of the friends I love."
"Kivrin," Dunworthy said.
"Come on," Colin said. "It's starting. Can't you hear the bell?"
"Yes," Dunworthy said. "It was Miss Piantini on the tenor, ringing the lead in to When at Last My Saviour Cometh."
Kivrin came and stood next to Dunworthy. She placed her hands together as if she were praying. "I can see Badri," Colin said. He cupped his hands around his mouth. "She's all right," he shouted. "We saved her." Miss Piantini's tenor clanged and the other bells chimed in joyously. The air began to glitter like snowflakes. "Apocalyptic," Colin said, his face alight. Kivrin reached out for Dunworthy's hand and clasped it tightly in her own. "I knew you'd come," she said.
And the net opened.
The End. You've been listening to Doomsday Book by Connie Willis, narrated by Jenny Sterling. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends these other time travel adventures: To Say Nothing of the Dog, also by Connie Willis, and Outlander by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalogue, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.